session number 4816, Reel 5.
Tomorrow in Reel 5. So Dougie was kept there, being wined and dined, and no doubt having a damn good time for the rest of the day until the evening when the guards from Lambsdorff came along to collect him, and of course, like everybody else, he got his whack of cells. Yeah. I suppose Dougie Barter had the same amount of cells as us. We got 14 days, the three of us got 14 days. And soon after getting out of cells, we were escorted, all of us, that's the 12 of us, were escorted to the Kommandantur one day. And lined up there, the commandant himself came out, behaving very much like a Dutch uncle. I can see him now standing on the steps there, looking down on us and telling us what foolish boys we were, that our parents or our families at home were worrying about us, or they'd worried a lot about us. No doubt when they heard we'd been taken prisoners, they thought, well, they're safe now until the end of the war. And what do? You risk your lives. You don't give up anything about your families. You don't think about your families. You let them worry there for you at home whilst you risk your lives unnecessarily, because it's impossible to escape. He said, but it's my duty to look after you. So I'm going to send you somewhere where you will be safe, where you will be looked after. He didn't tell us where it was, but that was his parting shot. So we'd no idea where we were going. So I think it was the next day we were escorted back to our little compound. The next day we were taken to Lambsdorff Station, which was my second visit to Lambsdorff Station. I think we went in a lorry this time, we didn't walk, and got on the train. And again we were surprised there, because the whole platform at Lambsdorff had been cleared. No sign of anybody. There were guards at each end of the platform. The platform was reserved for us. And when the train came, and we'd experienced this before, a couple of wagons were emptied. All the passengers in there were ordered out and told to find seats in another part of the train, and we got in. And this was in the morning, so it was quite a long trip from there, because it was getting on towards midnight when we arrived at Colditz station. But we had guards in our compartments, we had guards in the corridor. If you wanted to go to the loo, you were accompanied by a guard and you weren't allowed to shut the door. So we wondered what the hell this was all about. We got to Colditz station, and Colditz meant nothing to us, we'd never heard of the damn place. We got to Colditz station late at night. It must have been approaching midnight. And when the train pulled up at Colditz station and we looked out of the windows, all we could see was the whole platform there lined with guards, all with their rifles across their shoulders, and other guards with dogs. And I didn't take an awful lot of notice of that. We were roused out of off the train and just lined up loosely, bunched together loosely. And just one incident there which had repercussions soon after was somebody nudged me and said, look, you chaps, don't move for a little while, stay where you are for a while. And I didn't even know who it was who said that. But there was an argument going on the platform soon afterwards, soon after that, when we were being counted. We were one short, and there was an argument between the guards who came with us and the guards who were waiting for us. The guards who came with us said there were 12 when we arrived here, and the guards waiting on Colditz station said, well, there weren't 12, there were only 11, count them for yourselves, and there were only 11. And this went on for quite a time. In the meantime, the train had pushed off, and Billy Stevens was missing. I don't suppose this put the guards in much of a humour. When we got outside the station, there were two lines of guards, and There were machine guns there, and there were dogs, and we were lined up in between these and marched off. But the first thing you could see was this damn great castle stuck up on top of the hill and completely floodlit. And we still had no idea where we were. We guessed that that's where we were heading for, but it was absolutely awe-inspiring. And we marched up through Colditz town to the castle, and when we got there, it was obvious it was a fairly grim sort of place, because we went through three long, low archways, each with guards, and our armed guards with their rifles at the ready on both sides, and we had guards all around us, guards behind us, until we got after the third archway, which was in between high walls. We got to a big studded gate. I know, one of these heavy great things, an arch-shaped gate, a big studded gate. And we stopped there, and we were counted again there, and the gate was opened, or at least the sort of portcullis gate was opened, or door was opened. We walked in there into this courtyard, and as soon as we got in there, first of us stepped in the door, there's one hell of a damn din there, bugles blowing and shrieks and shouts, and these were all the other chaps who'd heard that the Navy was arriving, and they were all there, these were British, French, Dutch, Poles, Serbs, the whole bloody lot were there, all shouting their heads off, and we were led up by a couple of guards to the British quarters there. Of course, we were surrounded by everybody. And introductions and so on. Of course, they all wanted news, which, when new prisoners arrive, this is the first thing they want, news of what's going on outside, things they hadn't heard of. But we hadn't been there more than half an hour before there was a shout of, "Halt! Halt!" And in came a German officer, at least chap we assumed to be a German officer, dressed in a long white coat and a German officer's cap, with an attendant in a white smock, and we're told this is the bloody Stabsarzt, the German doctor that always gives the new arrivals a thorough medical examination. And this was up in this room up the top of the castle, which was our quarters. And all the other chaps were around the room, standing and kneeling and sitting and whatever, around the room, chiacking this German doctor, shouting insults at him. And he was shouting insults back at them and threatening them with punishment and so on. And we thought, well, God, something strange here, because, we'd never have dared to shout at a German officer like that, because the guard had a gun with him. At least it looked like a gun. We found out later it was a homemade imitation. And we had to line up to be medically examined. And as you got to the table, he got a bowl of some purplish coloured liquid there, and a stick in it, and a brush. And we're ordered in the usual way to drop them. We dropped them, and the orderly there lifted up our private parts and painted them with this foul-looking material. And all the time, this shouting was going on, and the shouting was coming back from a chap we thought was a German officer. But this was Howard G. Oh, it was one hell of a bloody character. Was Howard G. He'd been described as a soldier of fortune, and I suppose he was. A chap with an amazing brain. He had a brain like a sponge. If he wanted to learn something, it was just like dipping the sponge in water, and the water was the knowledge, and it just absorbed it like that. He had that sort of brain.
You mean he was dressed up as a German officer?
Yes, he was dressed up as a German officer. Yes, indeed. Yes, that was Howard G. Howard had been picked up in Norway. I was going to say, if you remember, because you won't remember, in end of 1939, when the Russians, in 1939, when the Russians invaded Finland, and a Finnish volunteer brigade was formed in the UK. Howard G., who also, like Giles Romilly had been in the Spanish Civil War. He volunteered for the Finnish Brigade, as did Giles Romilly. In fact, those two were picked up together. And when they got to Finland, after quite a difficult journey, the Finns just said, "We don't bloody well want you." You know, and I remember reading this in the papers. And they're making their way back through Norway at the same time as the Germans invaded Norway, and they were picked up. And they're both in Colditz when I arrived there. Giles, because he was Winston Churchill's nephew, and so he was a Prominente, and Howard, because he was, well, a 100% Deutscher Feindlicher, an enemy of the Reich. Very outspoken chap, you know. He wouldn't be pushed under at all. If he wanted to say something, he said it, you know, whatever the consequences. So this was Howard G. So that was our arrival at Colditz. The next morning, the 12 of us who'd arrived after Appell, there were four Appells a day as standard at Colditz. After the morning Appell, everyone was told to get back to their rooms, except we chaps who had arrived the previous evening. And when the courtyard was cleared, except for us, and Germans came in carrying equipment, photographic equipment and fingerprinting equipment, and fixed it up in the corner of the courtyard with a stand to take our photographs, identity photographs and fingerprints and so on. And I was the first one behind this, and I stood behind this stand, which had my POW number stuck in there. There was me stuck above the stand, and there was my POW number. And I was just standing there, looking, waiting for the birdie, when all of a sudden, crash, and water bombs came from the windows up there, crash, knocked the camera out of the photographer's hand, onto the fingerprinting apparatus. That was smashed. It was glass. That was smashed. Before I knew where I was, bloody shots being fired. You know, the guards were firing shots up at the window. And I thought again, God almighty, this is a queer bloody place. And the guards went rushing upstairs, up to the English quarters. And in the meantime, they cleared all the gear away and took us outside into the German courtyard, and we had our photographs taken out there and our fingerprints. But this was our introduction. And on the first day, that same day, at lunchtime, if you can call it lunchtime, and I suppose you could in 1942, because the German soup wasn't too bad. I think it was at lunchtime or dinner time, whatever you like to call it. Sitting down peacefully at table, knocking back my soup and spuds, and I saw a chap get up down there and walk towards me with his plate in his hand, walked up behind me and smashed his plate across my head. And I thought, what the hell's this made of? And somebody else said, don't take me notice of that. I won't give you the chap's name, but there was, a couple of weeks ago, they repeated one incident in this, you know, really ridiculous cowboy series that the BBC produced.
The Colditz series.
The Colditz series, yes. And this one was about a chap who, in order to get repatriated, pretended to be round the bend, and pretended so bloody hard that, in fact, in the end, he was round the bend, you see. And a hell of a lot of chaps said that Don was, take me notice of him, he's putting it on. But Don wasn't putting it on at all. He was in fact repatriated, but not until, I think it was October or November 1944. And I heard a rumour some years ago that before I became involved in running the Colditz Association, I heard a rumour that he was still in a mental hospital in Canada, because he was a Canadian. And prior to the reunion, I tried to find out where he was, and in the end, and trying to find other people as well, got in touch with the Canadian High Commissioner, and he did the hunting around for me, and he found Don. He'd been in a mental hospital ever since the war, in and out. But at the time, he was living somewhere outside Quebec, and he had a nurse in attendance all the time. But the outcome of that, through the good offices of the Canadian High Commissioner, was that Don Tom and his nurse were flown over to our reunion. And
so he hadn't started out by feigning madness?
No, well, you know, some chaps at the time said yes, but no, I never... many others never thought that that was the case. But you never knew, you see, because, you know, there were one or two who adopted all sorts of weird tactics, because repatriation as such was out when the first repatriation boards went around Germany. There's no doubt they went around England. They never came to Colditz. Colditz was left out. And I often think back on Dan Halifax. He was a very great chum of mine. We used to walk around the courtyard together an awful lot and natter. And when I first saw Dan, he arrived in Colditz perhaps a year after I did. When I first saw Dan, I found it terribly difficult to react. He was a fighter pilot. I forget whether it was a Spitfire or a Hurricane. But his plane had been shot up. His oxygen mask had caught fire. And his face was terribly badly burnt. His ears had been burnt off. His nose had been virtually burnt off. And his face was, you know, really shocking. His hair had been burnt off, and he just got one or two sprouts of hair. His hands were like claws. And it was a terribly difficult situation, because, you know, one wasn't prepared for that. One couldn't find the right approach. But as I got to know Dan, well, his disfigurement just disappeared. You know, he was no longer disfigured. He was such a charming, delightful chap. And Dan and I got to know one another very well indeed. And, of course, a hell of a lot of toing and froing went on through the normal channels between the SBO and the protecting power, which had to go through the, obviously, through the Commandantur. About Dan and one or two others. And when the first repatriation board came along to Colditz, which was towards the end of 1944, Dan was on this, and in the event he was passed for repatriation. But when he was passed, in that interval between being passed and him leaving the camp, I said to Dan one day, I said, look, because he said he was so eager to get repatriated, because he wanted to get to the skin grafting people, and whether I think it was at Stoke Mandeville at that time, but wherever it was, that's what he wanted, you know, because he was full of this conviction that the longer it was left, the more impossible it would be to repair him. So, you know, repatriation was of desperate importance to him. So, of course, we're all delighted. And walking around the courtyard after we heard that he'd been successful and that he would be repatriated, one day I said to him, I said, look, Dan, I said, as soon as you get home, you'll be along for your operations. Now, would you promise to let me know how things are going on? I said, we should be sitting there in the background wondering how the hell things are going. I'm sure we know they're going to go well, but, you know, it'd be nice to know. He says, yes, Mike, of course I will. And I'll make a point of giving a progress report. Well, after when I got home, I'd heard nothing from Dan for about a year. And after my repatriation leave, I went back to sea again. And I wrote to Dan and said, oh, look, Dan, you did say you'd let me know. And, you know, I think about it a lot. And I got a letter back from his mother. He'd been along to see the surgeons for their assessment and for them to make preparations. And in the meantime, he felt he'd like to go up flying again, which he'd done, crashed and killed himself. So that was the end of Dan. But Don was repatriated, as I say, and there were others. Harry Elliott Oh, he's still going strong. Well, he's still going. He's not terribly strong as Harry. But he was one who faked everything, and he went through, you know, one hell of a bloody time. Harry did fake it well. Not madness, but illness, you know, every conceivable illness he faked. But then, you never knew where you bloody well were. There was old Mickey Wynn. Mickey was a particular buddy of mine. We were together in Marlegg, although he wasn't in on our tunnel, because he'd only just arrived at Marlegg when I left Marlegg, and he arrived in Colditz perhaps a year or so after I arrived there. Now Mickey Wynn was on the Saint-Nazaire raid. He was Lieutenant RNVR, and he was in command of the only MTB at Saint-Nazaire. There were a number of MGBs, motor gunboats, but only one MTB. And if you've read the story, which I assume you have, you know that the Campbelltown had her bows laden with explosives, and she rammed the dock gates. But Mickey's MTB was there in reserve in case something went wrong with the Campbelltown. She could have been sunk on the way down the estuary. And if the Campbelltown pulled off her job, his job was to blow up one of the wet docks, the gates of one of the wet docks, which he did. But a hell of a lot of the MGBs had been shot out of the water. And when Mickey had got rid of his torpedoes and he was ready to push off from Saint-Nazaire, he got on board the crew of another MTB, of an MGB, plus a lot of the commandos, and going up the river to rendezvous with the destroyers at the mouth of the estuary. And the orders, as I understood from Mickey, the orders were strictly not to stop for anything, just to go hell for bloody leather. Well, no, don't stop for anything. Don't stop for survivors. Stop for nothing. Mickey was belting up. He picked up by searchlights and the guns, and he evaded them. And going up the river, he saw some chaps clinging to a buoy, and they waved and shouted at him, shoved his brakes on them, pulled up and started pulling them aboard when the searchlights and the guns picked him up and shot him out of the water. Well, only two or three survivors from that lot, and old Mickey lost an eye, and he lost a couple of fingers, and had a few bits of shrapnel here and there. Well, Mickey was in my mess. As soon as the first breath of repatriation came along, old Mickey went ill. He just couldn't stand. Every time he got to his feet, it hurt like hell. He staggered and fell over and so on, and was confined to the sick bay, which was just a room that excused chaps from going on a pal. And he was in my mess, and my mess was 88, and I know that number so well. 88 stone steps up in that corner, and the sick bay was across the courtyard and somewhere about 40 steps up there. And I used to take his rations across to him, and everybody else can say, old Darby and Hughes to say, well, you're a bloody fool, Mike, you know, there's nothing wrong with a bugger, he's just putting it on. And I perhaps thought, well, perhaps he is putting it on, but I'll go along with it anyhow. And Mickey, I knew he was a farmer, and he said, Mike, he said, after the war I'll give you a mountain. And I said, what the hell am I going to do with a mountain? He said, well, nice to own a mountain, Mike. He said, I'll give you one after the war. It meant nothing at all. But some years ago, when my son Peter was about 16, he was never a very good pupil at school. He just wouldn't take an interest at school. He was at King's in Rochester. And they decided he wanted to join the army, and after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing and arguing, I said, okay, well, if that's what you want to do, you do it. So he joined a junior leaders regiment at Oswestry. And on his first term, halfway through, parents were invited to see them march and parade and so on, see how their sons were getting up, Rena and I went up there for this weekend, and I thought, oh, good God, now, well, Mickey Wynn only lives about 15 miles away. He lives at Corwen. I'll pop along to see him.
Where?
Corwen, in North Wales. C-O-R-W-E-N. So I hopped in the car, took Peter with me, hopped in the car, went along to Corwin. I got his address because we'd written to one another from time to time, and popped into the local post office and in Corwin and asked them if they knew where Mr. Michael Wynne lived. Mr. Michael Wynne, man, no, Mr. Michael Wynne around here. And somebody said, ah, yes, that used to be Mr. Michael Wynne, that's now Lord Newborough. And told me where he was, and I drove along there. And came to the entrance, bloody great big gates with a lodge on either side, and I rang a bell. And the chap at the gate came to the lodge, and I said, well, for God's sake, you're not to ring up and say, I'm here. And I explained who I was, an old POW chum, and he opened the gate and I went up. And it was just getting dusk, and a bloody great big mansion there with stone pillars all the way along and a chain there to pull. I pulled the chain and heard the bell tingling in the background, and a door opened, and a youngster opened the door, a youngster of about Peter's age. Peter was 16 or 16 and a half then, something like that. And he said, you know, whatever one would say, good evening, what can I do for you, or whatever it was. And I said, I've come to collect a mountain. He looked at me, I beg your pardon. I said, I've come to collect a mountain. He didn't know what the hell to make of this. He thought, well, Christ, we've got a funny chap here. But Mickey was in the background and recognised my voice. He came rushing out, Christ, Muggsy, come on in. In we went, a bottle of whiskey on the table before you knew where we were, and suits of armour all over the place. And he said, well, Mike, if you want a mountain, you can have a mountain. Got so many bloody mountains, I don't know what to do with them. Of course, I wouldn't know what to do with a mountain anyhow. But that was Mickey, who was a wonderful character. And after the first I heard of him, other than in our correspondence and the rare occasions when we met up with one another, was when headlines in the paper, he's got a lot of salmon fishing on one of his estates. He's got a river, is it the River Dee, runs through there and gets a hell of a lot of poachers, and he'd rigged up a cannon on one side of the back with cannonballs, an old-fashioned cannon and cannonballs, and he used to fire across the river at these poachers, missing them. But he also stretched wires across the river under the water. Mucky, I can say that I'm on Mickey's side there, and perhaps I'm on the poacher's side there, but nevertheless, this was Mickey Wynne. And when they were fishing for salmon illegally, insofar as the law is concerned, and as the boat got close, so they'd winch up this bloody wire and the boat would run into it. This was Mickey Wynne.
Did he get repatriated?
Yes, he got repatriated, Mickey did, yes. In fact, I still got the letter. The first thing he did when he got home is to write to Rena and say that Mike and I have known one another for such a long time, we're together and at Marlag and in Colditz, and what a bloody good chap Mike is, and so on, you know, the usual dribble. And he invited Rena to dine with him up in town, and she had an absolutely wonderful evening up there. Oh, he's a wonderful chap. Oh, Mickey, soon after he got home, soon after the war, he was appointed the chairman of the magistrates in that district, and this lasted about 6 months when he was kicked out. This is not surprising. I'd have been surprised if he hadn't been kicked out.
I think at Colditz you also came across various members of the aristocracy. Is there anything you'd like to say about them?
They were a mixture, of course, as we all were. There were one or two, and I won't mention any names, who not only were aristocracy but regarded themselves as aristocracy. But there were others who were just one of the boys. And I'm thinking particularly of chaps like Charlie Hopetown, who was the son of the Viceroy of India. He was just one of the boys into all the mischief that was going. Michael Alexander, who was in my mess. Now, Michael, if he'd listened to this, Michael won't mind me saying this. He was a lazy bugger, was Michael. We used to take our turns at doing the work in the mess, you know, what we call stooging, preparing the food, dividing the rations, and the rations had to be divided equally. I mean, we got a 20th of a loaf each, and we got enough bread for 8 men, or whoever, however many there were in our mess, and this had to be divided exactly, you know, each slice had to be of precisely the same thickness so that nobody got more than anyone else, you see. So this was quite a responsible job, peeling the potatoes, because we used to get our potatoes boiled in their jackets from the galley, and then you had to peel them. And there was only one way of peeling potatoes in those days, and that was, and if you've ever eaten a boiled potato in its jacket, or had a boiled potato in its jacket, but there's only one way of peeling them, and that's you get the potato in your knife and you get the edge of the skin and you pull the skin off, so that all you pulled off the potato was skin. You didn't peel any potato off. And Michael, in the last months of the war, I can remember so very, very clearly Michael volunteering to help with peeling the spuds. And instead of dealing with the potatoes as I'd said they should be dealt with, he peeled them with the back of a spoon and piled them up in front of him on the table, sprinkled salt on them, and down the hatch.